Good evening. It's Rabbi Feldman's shiur, Monday night, June 15th. Tonight's shiur is Zecher Nishmas, Tzipora Tamara Bas Zev.
Good evening. The topic that was announced, the topic of organ donations, is a highly, highly sensitive and controversial topic. The truth is perhaps one of the most serious issues that is debated in contemporary halakhic discussion, perhaps the most serious issue with the most serious consequences on both sides. I generally don't speak out to talk about this topic or talk about the topic because it was requested, and I agree on the understanding that I'm not going to take a stand. I'm not going to try to be machria among the various opinions that are addressing this issue. Again, it's an issue of tremendous, tremendous consequence. It's an issue where there really isn't a safe side because the stakes are that high that either way you go, there are tremendous risks involved and tremendous halakhic values at stake. So my only intent is to provide a little bit of a survey, a little bit of an overview of some of the issues, and hope that we can come to understand all the various positions a little bit better. And there is some significant misinformation about this topic as well. Some of the things that are printed in newspapers and everybody talks about the Jewish position on this issue, a lot of the things you see in newspapers I don't think is at all accurate. They're close to accurate. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about that. For example, you find the newspapers will sometimes say that some Orthodox Jews oppose organ transplants because of concerns about cremation, that they want the body to be whole for the resurrection of the dead, something like that. I don't know where that comes from. I don't think it comes from any halakhic source. I don't think that that's at all a part of the discussion. And it's important to emphasize because it's not something that people really can understand why that would necessarily impact discussion. I think the answer is it doesn't. I don't know where the newspapers get it from. It's not something that you find in the real literature. And the issues that that do affect this issue are issues that are very serious and very real. Again, on both sides of the equation. And there are also many of them, so it's pretty much clear that we're not going to finish the topic tonight. This will be a two-part topic. We'll talk a little bit tonight and continue with God willing in 2 weeks. And probably the more controversial issues will be more in part two. Part one will deal with what's a little bit more straightforward, although it also has its tremendous complexity to it. I mostly focus on organ donations that come from living donors and the issues that arise when the donor is no longer living. Those are the issues which are more complex, revolve around issues of definition of death, which is a very, very sensitive and complicated topic. But to begin with, just first of all, a word in terms of the pursuit of medical healing. We know that Jews have always had a healthy respect for doctors, and this is true from a halachic perspective as well. We certainly accept the pursuit of the healing arts, of engaging in medicine, and more than that, we believe it to be a mitzvah. The Torah tells us in Parshas Mishpatim, "Rapo yirape," that there is an obligation to heal, and so much so that it's a discussion in the poskim. How we even allow doctors to get paid. And maybe we should assume that this is a basic religious obligation, it's not an option, and therefore it should be something that perhaps should be done for free, and that's clearly not the case. How exactly that operates in a halakhic framework is somewhat of a discussion, touching upon the topic of schar batala, that a person has the right to be paid for the time that he would have spent doing other things, and especially if it's a profession that takes a high degree of training. So that means a lot of time that could have gone towards other things, a lot of effort could have gone towards other things, and the person could have been doing very profitable things at that time. That's part of the equation. That's not a topic we're going to get into in such detail, but it highlights the fact that we're dealing here with not only something that we recognize, but something that we believe is a basic core obligation. And it's interesting that as much as that's the case, the Gemara has in the Shachas Bava Kama, a phrase needs a little bit of understanding. And interpreting this phrase, Rapo Yirapesh, the Gemara in the 8th Parak of Bava Kama, Nachogo, has a comment, Yikan Sheyesh Rishos L'Rochei L'Rapos. You see from here that there is permission given for the doctor to heal. So in light of what we just said, that it's not only permission, it's an obligation. So that makes this phrase even harder to understand. Why would I think that we need permission? It seems to be a good thing to do on the surface. And especially if we do understand it to be the mitzvah that it is. So that makes the statement even more surprising. So what does this Gemara mean when it says that there is permission given to the doctor to heal? So you find essentially two approaches in the Rishonim, perhaps more than that, but the two prominent approaches in the Rishonim, Tosfos talks about Baruch Hanan and other Rishonim talk about. One is spiritual, philosophical, and one is legal. That's from a philosophical perspective. So one perhaps could have put forth the argument that maybe it's not my job to play God, that maybe I shouldn't interfere with the way the world is being run by God. If he wants people to be sick, so maybe that's the way it's supposed to be. Maybe I am somehow interfering with a divine plan if I engage in medicine. And of course, that's not the attitude that we take. One could have taken the same approach to charity as well. One could say a person is poor, so then that's the way God wants him to be. And the Gemara does relate, Chazal have stories of debates on this point, Tzemach Rishus and Rabbi Akiva, different discussions that are had around this point, but this is clearly not the Jewish attitude, that we don't assume that just because somebody is suffering, somebody is poor, somebody is sick, it's because God wants it to be that way and we have to leave it alone. But we understand that we are charged to try to help those situations, and where we find suffering, we're supposed to try to address it. And if we're in the ability to help somebody with money, so we're supposed to get stuck. And if we have the ability to help somebody with our services and to help them be healed, so then that's an obligation, which is also derived from the obligation of Hasav Shaveda. And the Torah tells us that we're supposed to return somebody's lost property. If we see something that somebody in this place, we're supposed to give it back to them. So the Gemara says this is not only true by physical property, it's true by their most important property, it's true by their health as well. If somebody is in a position to restore somebody's health, well, then that's certainly a much more valuable form of Hashav HaShaveda, and all of it is connected to that. So that's an obligation, and we don't take the attitude that that's the way the world is. Apparently God wants it that way, we shouldn't interfere. No, yesh reshus l'rofei l'rapos. That's one of the approaches that we find in the Rishonim. That's the one that's more philosophical in nature. The other is more legalistic in nature, because maybe we would say that, listen, for example, a person is a surgeon, so he's going to cut into a person. So that's an invasive thing to do, and that's, technically speaking, an act of assault. Now, it's one thing, maybe it's one thing if we say, if we know that you're 100% going to definitely help the person, so then, okay, we could understand that that's going to outweigh what you're doing to him, that you're technically speaking, assaulting him, cutting him up. But that's not even always the case. Very often a doctor's going to do something and he's not sure that it's going to work. So who gives me the right to cut somebody up, to invade somebody else's body when I'm not sure it's going to work? So from a legal perspective, we do need some type of specific statement that says that when a person is a properly qualified professional, and that becomes also an important part of the discussion, a person has to know what he's doing, and that also has to be a part of the analysis. But assuming that a person knows as much as it's reasonable for the person to know, and is engaging in the responsible pursuit of medicine, so then that doesn't constitute a crime against the patient who he's trying to serve. And that's from a Choshen Mishpat perspective, we find this discussion in terms of Dayanim as well. The person is engaged in adjudicating cases, so sometimes the person can make a mistake, and that mistake could end up costing somebody money. So what's the liability that a Dayan has in that context? So all of that, in order for a person to even enter into this whole pursuit, so we need to be told that there is a concept of the legitimate practice of medicine, and therefore that addresses and that informs the whole discussion from a monetary legalistic perspective. So that's the second approach that you find in the Rishonim that explains why the Gemara would tell us that not only is it a mitzvah to heal, but we have permission to heal. What that refers to, that's the other possibility, which is perhaps related to the comments of Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra, in his commentary to Chumash, in Parshas Mishpatim, has a statement which I don't think any of the poskim, certainly not nowadays, I don't think anybody accepted the halacha, but it's interesting in terms of what it reflects. So Ibn Ezra had an interpretation that this permission to heal only refers to external wounds. That's something that the doctor can see, and he can see what he's doing. There's a heter to fix, but if it's something internal where he's not going to be able to see what's going on, so then there isn't such license. So clearly this is not an attitude we take, at least not nowadays. I don't know if anyone ever accepted this attitude by halacha, but it seems to sync with this type of understanding, that maybe there's a somewhat of a judgment call, that when there's some type of reasonable ability to assess what you're doing, then you can take certain risks and you can go ahead and heal people. But when it's literally you're going around the dark, you can't see what's happening, so then it starts to shift towards the other side of the equation. And again, it's not a practical guideline, but it does address somewhat some of the trade-off that's involved, and maybe why the Gemara has to tell us that this is a pursuit that we have permission to get involved in. So all of this is very relevant when we start considering the issue of transplants and the issue of donating a part of your body to somebody else. So as science advances and as medical technology advances, so it's getting better and better every year, but certainly when it started, and still to some extent now, this is a risky and somewhat speculative endeavor, that we don't really know what's going to happen to the donor, and we don't really know what's going to happen to the recipient. And that's a big part of the discussion, and it's a complicated part to talk about from a straight halakhic perspective, because it involves a lot of calculating subjective variables, but we just need to be aware that this is part of the discussion. And there are different types of things a person can donate. A person can donate, for example, blood. Technically speaking, that's also a donation from one's body, and that entails far less risk. So there, we clearly see a value to that which has less of a trade-off. But then there are other types of donations that a person could donate from his body, from his living body, that either incur a lot more pain, like for example a bone marrow transplant is a very painful process, or incur some level of risk towards the person donating. So what exactly is the story there? So that gets a little more complicated. We have an obligation in theory that the Torah tells us in Parshas Kedoshim that lo samar al dam re'echa, so a person is suffering, a person is in risk, person has some type of sakana happening to him, whether it's his money or it's his body, as the Rambam explains in the Sefer HaMitzvos. Dam has a connotation both of monetary goods, damim, also has a connotation of blood, of your life, so a person is at risk, so we're not supposed to stand by and to let that happen. So we understand that to be not only an obligation, but alosa, say, technically speaking, prohibited to not step in. It's an interesting question, which the Achronim discussed. I don't have a really good answer to. But maybe when somebody comes and asks me for a charitable donation because somebody needs a life-saving surgery, so maybe a person should be obligated to give all of his money. Because there's a biblical prohibition here. We normally assume that in order not to violate a prohibition, you have to give all your money. So it doesn't seem to be the case. Otherwise, we'd all be emptied out very quickly. Why not? This topic needs a little bit of explanation. Chaim Ozer and Maheshes and others discussed this question. It's possible that we won't classify it as a prohibition, that even though it has the language of a prohibition, but essentially it's passive. You'll stand by and not do something. So there are those Achronim who thought that that's considered like a mitzvah, even though it uses negative language. But still, a mitzvah also requires a lot. So how we don't all start emptying out our wallets every time somebody needs surgery, it's a good question why exactly that's not required, but certainly there is a lot of attention that we have to pay when somebody needs life-saving help, and it becomes particularly acute if you are in a unique position to offer this help. This is not something that other people will be in an equal position to do. It's something that requires a certain type of blood type or a certain type of compatibility that you have that others don't, so that does reframe the issue somewhat. It does become a much more of an acute type of calling, where it's not the case that if you say no, they'll just keep going a little bit longer, they'll go to the next door, they'll make a few more announcements. That does call attention a little bit more. So the question is, what if it's not just a tip club, but it involves some type of risk? So if it involves a risk, so that's an important question. The Rishonim, in commenting on the phrase, Lo Samar Al Dam Re'echa, Rashi and the Rambam and others, so they have a language that you're obligated to save somebody else's life if you're sure you can save their life. So why do you have to say that? Why shouldn't I try even if I'm not sure? So a lot of the Achronim understood that what Rashi and Rambam were getting at is that because they're assuming that it involves a sakana to you as well, that it involves some type of risk to you and what you're going to do. And therefore, so we're saying that if you can definitely save somebody else's life, but involves taking on some type of risk for yourself. So there is still a mitzvah to do so. There is a mitzvah to save that person's life, even when it means risking your own life. And this seems to be based on a comment in the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi has an attitude which is reflected in a number of places, very inspiring position, where it sees all of the Jewish people as one body. For example, the Yerushalmi Maseches Nedarim has a comment about the prohibition of taking revenge. The Torah tells us, "Losito v'lo shito restanei amecha." So the Yerushalmi has an example. What does it mean you're going to take revenge? So let's say a person accidentally hits his head with his hand. He says, okay, I'm going to take revenge on my hand. Shouldn't have hurt my head. That doesn't make sense. So he's going to hurt your hand and your head. So if you see all of the Jewish people as one body, so you're going to realize it doesn't make any sense to take revenge on anybody else. So too, the attitude that the Yerushalmi has is that all of the Jews are all one body. So the same way, so you would try to save as much as you can of yourself. So too, essentially, it comes somewhat from a statistical perspective. And if you have a 100% chance of saving somebody else's life, or close to 100% chance, and it involves a lower percentage of risk to you, so maybe the numbers could still work out that it makes sense to save somebody else's life, even putting yourself at risk. So this is the attitude that seems to emerge from the Yerushalmi. It's a very powerful concept. It's questionable whether or not we accept that halacha. We don't find that our poskim necessarily quote that view of the Yerushalmi, and it's very possible it's because the Talmud Bavli disagrees. That there is a discussion the Gemara has in Maseches Nida, where the story is told that Rabbi Tarfon had the opportunity. There were some people who were being chased by the government, presumably illegitimately, and their lives were at risk. And Rabbi Tarfon was asked to give them a place to stay, to give them quarter. And he declined because he felt that his life would be at risk, that they'll just come to his house and they'll find them and then they'll go after him. So because he didn't want to put his own life at risk, so therefore he didn't take this action to save the lives of these people who were running away and trying to escape. So there were those who understand that therefore the attitude the Bavli is displaying here is that even though one's obligated to save somebody else's life, if they can do so, but not if it means they have to risk their own life. Certainly not everyone agrees it means you have to sacrifice your life. That even your Yerushalmi would agree that you're not supposed to sacrifice your life to save somebody else's, but your Yerushalmi would say that you should risk your life, again, if it makes statistical sense. While when it comes to the Bavli seems to say you don't even necessarily have to risk your life. So if we say that you don't have to, so does that mean that you're not permitted to? Maybe that means that we should look at it like suicide. We know the person doesn't have the right to commit suicide. It's not something you can volunteer to do. So if we say that you're not obligated to risk your life, so does that mean that you're not permitted to risk your life? So that doesn't seem to be the case. The Radbaz, in his Shuvah, the Shuvah that may later Sparim quote, so the Radbaz takes the view that this is at least something that one does have the right to do, even if we assume that one's not obligated to do. And therefore, the Yerushalmi in spirit seems to express itself, even if not as an obligation. So one has the right to say that I'm not going to risk my life, that I'm not mukhayyaf to, but there is certainly a nobility that's involved in doing so, and that shows a certain type of recognition of obligation that we have to others, and therefore that is certainly something that one could take upon oneself. And then the question again is, there is this numerical element which is going to change all the time. It's going to change from case to case. There's all kinds of variables. What are the odds of success of the surgery? What is the risk to the donor? And also, what is the overall benefit? Sometimes the question is, you may have a patient who, if you leave him alone, so he's expected to live for another few months. If you have, if you give the surgery, so then there's a 50% chance he'll live for another 10 years, and there's a 50% chance he'll die on the table. So it's a complicated mathematics to work out. So all of these issues are very complex, and it's constantly changing. You know, the science is constantly getting better, and processes are constantly being refined. So this is not something that we can really look at in the abstract, in any absolute sense, but these are part of the questions that come into play. So what about if we're not talking about risking your life, but we're talking about giving up an organ? So giving up an organ, let's say that doesn't necessarily, let's assume, which is also a fluid situation, but let's assume that it doesn't necessarily entail risking your life, but it entails giving up a part of you. So are you obligated to give up a part of you to save somebody else's life, even if we assume that you're not obligated to risk your own actual life? So this was also discussed in the Radbaz. Radbaz quotes from the Rikanti a view that one is obligated to give up an organ to save somebody. One is obligated to give up an aver to save somebody's life. He's discussing, let's say you have, it's hard to imagine a scenario, let's say you have a group of terrorists who say, we're going to kill somebody here unless somebody cuts off his arm. It's hard to imagine the time of the time of recounting what exactly the scenario was, but that's the situation. A person has the ability to save somebody else's life, but he has to cut off his arm, he has to cut off his leg. So is he obligated to do that? So the Rikanti thought that he was obligated. He was looking at Hilchos Shabbos. When it comes to Hilchos Shabbos, so we assume that one is obligated to be Mechal Shabbos in order to save a life. But what about to save a limb, save an arm or a leg? So that's a more complicated question. So Chon Aruch didn't think so. Didn't think he could be Mechal Shabbos for that. Now the Shach happens to disagree, and Lahalacha L'maisa might be a different approach, but the Rikanti was working off of this approach that the Shulchan Aruch has, that there is a distinction in terms of Chil Shabbos between saving a life and saving one's limb. So therefore, extrapolating from there, that just because we say you don't have to give up your life to save somebody else doesn't mean you don't have to give up your limb. If the other person is looking at death and you're looking at losing a limb, so the Rikanti thought you would be obligated to lose a limb for that purpose. And the Radbaj did not accept this. Rav Ash thought this was incorrect. And he said, there's, again, no obligation to give up even a limb to save somebody else's life. Now, does that mean that it's no Indian at all? It's not even a Midas Chashidus? So the truth is, Rav Ash did think that way. He thought it wasn't even an Indian at all. And then it's Ziv in his commentary to the Shultz. But no, he said, it is a Midas Chashidus. It is something that we would be very admiring of. It is an expression of nobility. It's simply something that you wouldn't be obligated to do. That you have the right to say that my limbs are important to me. I can't give this up, you know, even for somebody else's life. So a lot of literature extrapolates from here to organs. So if you have a decision whether you want to keep your organ or give it up, so maybe it should be relevant to look a little bit at this question of the this discussion of the Rikanti and of the Radbaz. I'm not 100% convinced that they're exactly comparable, because there is a big difference between giving up an arm and giving up a kidney, both Lakula and Lachumra. That on the one hand, when it comes to the kidney, so one could say that that's worse because maybe that's going to shorten your lifespan. Now, to what extent does that shorten your lifespan nowadays is, again, debatable. Again, there's a lot of fluid math to work out here, and fluid technology and science to take into account, but on the one hand, one could take this as more chumer than losing an arm, because you could say, I could live without an arm, but my lifetime would be, my lifespan might be shortened without a kidney. On the other hand, one might view it as much more tal than giving up an arm. A person who gives up a limb is going to be both sacrificing a tremendous degree of functionality for the rest of his life, and is also going to undergo a certain degree of boshas. In the Torah, we refer to injuries on a bosha scale. A person is going to be visibly impaired for the rest of his life, so that's something that also goes into the equation. So one could seriously question whether or not giving up an internal organ is really comparable to giving up a limb. So even though in a lot of the classical literature there is a comparison drawn, one could make a strong case that it's really not the same, and that maybe one should be more ready to give up an organ than to give up a limb, and maybe even according to the Radbaz. So that's a little bit of discussion. And Poskim, again, have a lot of varied approaches to how we look at each individual case. And again, the basic parameters being that we're not, strictly speaking, obligated to undergo a sakana in order to save somebody else's life, nor are we necessarily obligated to give up a limb. But it may be that we're certainly allowed to risk our lives and perhaps even volunteer an actual limb, if not all the more so maybe an organ. And therefore, how exactly you do the math and how exactly you crunch the numbers is an extensive discussion in each case. For example, one could argue that any time a person has to undergo anesthesia, so anesthesia, general anesthesia, is some degree of risk. So one could say, well, maybe I shouldn't have to undertake any surgery in order to save somebody's life, because that's a sakana. And there are those who might take that position, and there are others who will say that, yes, it's a sakana, but it's the same type of sakana that an individual undertakes for elective purposes, or will undertake for other types of surgeries, even when they're not 100% life-threatening. So if one's ready to undergo that risk for other areas of life which are not as crucial, so then maybe it's not so, at least not so admirable to say I'm not willing to undergo that risk for the value of saving somebody else's life. And again, it's not always the case that you're for sure going to be saving somebody else's life, and that's also a part of the equation. So these are just some of the outside principles. Now, there is a major ethical discussion, which is also a hot controversial topic, the question of is it ever appropriate for the organ donor to be paid for his services, a person decides to give an organ, for him to be compensated financially. I guess there's also different degrees of what we're talking about in terms of being compensated. And it's one thing to pay for his medical bills, but also to pay above and beyond. So that's a very sensitive ethical and moral issue. Strictly speaking, from a halachic perspective, it's an interesting question whether it's really so troubling. Shaul Yisraeli, who was one of the great poskim of the modern-day Israeli society, passed away a number of years ago. So in his Shuvah Chavos Binyamin, so he has a discussion about this, and he's not so concerned about it. He doesn't think necessarily that it's such an ethical challenge. He thinks the question really goes back to the question we began with in terms of the doctors getting paid, that we have to figure out that is it an obligation for him to give the organ or not. So if it's an obligation, so maybe it's not right for him to get paid for just fulfilling his basic mitzvah obligation. But if it's something he doesn't necessarily have to do and he's choosing to do, so then if he that's the way he wants to do it, so he doesn't necessarily see this as an earth-shattering ethical problem. He thinks it all strictly depends just on that question. Would we view it as an absolute hope, or would we view it as less than that? And there are cases where some folks can consider that if the risk really is minimal and the degree of impairment that's going to give to the donor is also minimal, that it can reach a point where it is an absolute obligation, that even though we've been dealing mostly with the perspective that this is a voluntary act, but if the numbers are such where they really become overwhelming, so then post can have taken the attitude sometimes that where there's really a negligible risk and impairment on the donor and a significant value to the recipient, then it could be perhaps viewed as an obligation. Again, especially in those cases, like we mentioned earlier, where it's not just that anyone could donate, but only certain people are compatible, so then that makes the focus even more acute on the potential donor. And part of the question is related to what I've been saying the whole time about whether it's worth undergoing the pursuit also takes into account the level of risk that it has to a patient, which is also a broader medical ethics question, that even without getting involved in organ donations, so a patient always, very often a patient in a serious illness is confronted with the question of how much intervention is necessary, how much is advisable. So if I, again, leave it alone, you'll live X amount of time. Take an active intervention, and you may either live much longer or die right away. So here again, we're dealing with a statistical issue and an issue of probability, which involves a lot of complex factors. And that's also a part of the question whether the surgery is advisable, which is separate from the question of any concerns the donor has, just even whether the recipient should undergo this process. It's a question that's shared by many other types of more extreme type of medical intervention. And just related to that, so as we mentioned, we're probably not going to get into the issue of brain death now. We're a little bit, this is basically the dividing line between the living donations and the dead donations. Since we have a few minutes, maybe we'll talk a little bit about the donations from those who are deceased. But the issue of brain death, which I don't think we'll get to tonight, but just relevant to this point that we just said, so Rav Moshe Feinstein, in one of his earlier tshuvas about the heart transplants, which goes back about 40 years, back in the early days when heart transplants were really just being started. So Rav Moshe was at that point, certainly at that point, was opposed. And the language that he uses in one of his tshuvas about this topic is that to perform such a heart transplant would be a double murder. Why did he call it a double murder? Because he felt it would be a murder of the donor, that the donor having his heart taken out would be killing him. And again, that's something we'll get into more detail next time. But that it was also an act of murder towards the recipient, because the recipient, the odds of him surviving for a long time were very slim. And if you read some books were written recently detailing some of the early endeavors in terms of heart transplants, and the first few recipients, there was one in Brooklyn and one in South Africa, did not last very long at all. It was a matter of weeks at most. So the question of whether it's worth doing that to somebody who, without that, maybe would live at least a few months. So at that point, the level of medicine was sort of Moshe was saying that not only are you murdering the donor, but you're also, so to speak, murdering the recipient because you're causing it to die earlier, in addition to the fact that you are literally taking his heart out in order to replace it with a new heart. So that might be very directly an act of literal, or at least technical murder, combined with the fact that maybe his overall lifespan would be shortened very significantly. It's interesting that Rav Kasher, Nachum Kasher, is well known for his Torah Shlema. There's a number of other svarim which may not be as well known, but he also has tshuvas called Divrei Menachem, four volumes of tshuvas by that title, and he also has another sefer. He was very involved in bringing to publication the writings of the Ragachavar, the Tzapnas Paneach and the Torah, and other volumes of the Tzapnas Paneach. And he also wrote a volume called Mufaneach Tzachunas, where he talks about the Ragachavar's philosophy. And if you ever get involved in studying the Ragachavar, so you see that his whole approach to halacha is very closely connected to his philosophical approaches, and he analyzes this at length in Mufaneach Tzachunas. So here in this, he has a shuv in the Divrei Menachem about these issues, where he draws upon his philosophical Ragachavar studies, where he considers the fact that we don't necessarily assume, or the way he at least puts it forth, is that it's not necessarily the case that you're either alive or dead in A or B, but that it could be there's a process in between, that you may no longer be alive and you are not yet dead. So it's not necessarily called murder to put you in a state of non-life, which may be in between the two. So this addresses the Moshe's concerns. For example, when you're taking the heart out of the patient, so that technically killing him, even though you put a new heart in and then he'll live longer. So in that context, Kasher suggests that there is this kind of twilight zone in between, which may affect, the halakha may affect what exactly is going on here in terms of whether there is a real concern of rechicha involved. And that really does kind of segue into the next topic, into that topic which we'll discuss more at length next time, the question of the organs that one cannot give when one is alive. So no living person can say, I'll donate my heart to somebody because doing so will involve them dying. So that's only an option if the person is no longer alive. So then the question becomes, how exactly do you determine that's the case? And is it possible, the way many poskim have felt, and as we'll discuss more then, that maybe these two terms are mutually exclusive. Maybe having a heart to contribute and being deceased cannot coexist. That maybe the definition of life might be tied into having a heartbeat, and therefore it may be impossible to take a viable heart without causing an act of murder, so to speak, to take place. That is part of why the topic is such a thorny one, and all the issues of definition of death have tremendous implications even without coming into organ transplants. Very, very serious, emotionally serious, medically serious, financially serious, ethically serious considerations which require a lot of careful thought. So that one, we'll talk about that. Also talk about also some of the other issues which are a little bit less consequential, the issue of hanam and amase and nivel amase, autopsies, things like that, that are also affected by these questions and are also relevant to the issue of transplants from deceased individuals, which also factor into the equation. Just a quick rechazer we spoke about tonight. So we spoke about the obligation of healing, the Torah statements for apo yirape, the fact that it's taken as a mitzvah, and therefore it's even a question to figure out how can there be payments for healing, and the question, what does the Gemara mean when it says, mikan sheyesh reshus l'roth l'apos, why would we need permission? And the two basic approaches that we find in the Rishonim, either that's a philosophical chiddush, that we don't say that God made the world this way, we have to leave it, and we don't say also from a legal perspective that what right do I have to invade somebody else's body and risk hurting him further. No, we see this as a legitimate pursuit, assuming that it's undertaken with the right level of responsibility, and therefore that also flows from there. We mentioned Ibn Ezra's interesting idea that there is no permission given to the parts of the body that can't be seen. It's only for external healing. And again, not a position that was ever accepted of the halacha, but it reflects a certain attitude about what exactly was being discussed there. And then we talked about and the fact of the obligation of Losamad Adam Re'echa, and the fact that some of the Rishonim emphasize that if you can definitely help somebody, so then you're obligated to. So why should that make a difference? Some of the Achronim assume that we must be talking about a context where there is sakana to the person helping, and that's why we need this chiddush. And that was apparently a topic of machlokas between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi apparently seeing everybody is connected, so therefore even if one has to risk one's own life, if the odds are better in terms of saving somebody else's life, maybe mathematically it still makes sense. Similar to Yerushalmi's expressed attitude towards prohibition of taking revenge. And we saw the poskim don't seem to quote this, perhaps because the Bavli disagrees with the comment about the Tarfon not harboring fugitives because he was very worried about risking his own life. And then we saw the approach to Radbaz in the latest Svarim take, that even if one's not obligated, one is permitted to risk one's life to save somebody else's life. And then the question also goes to what about giving somebody else a limb, giving up a limb in order to save somebody else. The Ritanti thought one is obligated. The Radbaz disagreed. A little bit of a question whether even he would acknowledge Midas Chasidus, which the Nitzvah did acknowledge. And then we mentioned that a lot of the literature assumes that giving organs is comparable to giving limbs. And we mentioned that there is some room to question that, that maybe one could assume that even if one does not want to give a limb, giving an organ may not necessarily rise to that same type of level in terms of impairment or in terms of one's physical appearance and the like. And then we talked also about the question of selling organs, which is a major controversial ethical issue. From a halachic perspective, it's not clear it's necessarily such a problem. We mentioned that Rosh Hashanah Yisraeli discusses it in the context of just whether it's obligatory or not. If it's obligatory, then one presumably shouldn't be charging. If not, then maybe there's what to talk about. And that whole question about whether it's obligatory or not, we mentioned that there certainly do seem to be cases where it may rise to the level of obligatory once the risk and impairment level is negligible and the potential value is significant, and that's also something that is enhanced if the donor is in a unique position to donate that others are not in. And then we just discussed also the question of really all these types of interventions is also evaluated in light of the potential risk to the recipient, to the patient, and various cost-benefit ratios that are involved there as well. And we mentioned that Moshe's early assessment of heart transplants as a double murder. One murder we'll talk about next time, but the murder potentially of the patient there also, both because the lifespan afterwards was very short and because it involved actually taking the heart out of the person. So that first element that the lifespan has radically changed over the four decades since that was first written, but also in terms of the status of life and death. So we mentioned Rav Kasher's philosophical halachic analysis that it's not necessarily the case that there's only two states, you're either alive or you're dead, but maybe there's an in-between, and that somewhat segues into our next discussion about when exactly do we define life as ending and how that impacts on some of the more difficult parts of this discussion. Okay, so, So it does, you know, we're strictly speaking, again, if we assume that one's not obligated to do this on a basic level, so it's already something that's voluntary, so one does have a right to factor in how much suffering one takes. But there are those, certainly Yerushalmi presumably would assume that if it's a question of somebody else's life versus the pain of the donor, and the donor is going to recover from the pain, so from the Yerushalmi perspective, then it's hard to imagine that there would be that would be a reason not to do it. I think others, even those who pass them like the Bavli, which presumably is the mainstream approach, but even within the Bavli's approach, there is room to assume that pain is less, but somewhat fluctual, somewhat variable. And again, certainly it would be agreed that it's definitely a big discussion to undergo in terms of the fact that you can save somebody else's life. It's going to certainly outweigh the big picture sense. Hi. yes and no. Yes.